I didn't want to eat there. But Sue, who, by the way, who was planning to help decorate her daughter's house and come home, is stranded in South Bend this morning. And that Sue of which I speak said, I had to. We were driving to Muncie to hand our granddaughters over to their parents. Sarah called and said, why don't you meet us at Steak and Shake? I groaned to Sue. I said, I can't stand Steak and Shake. She said, look, it's not going to kill you. I said, you don't know that. I said, their food is awful and the service is worse. Tell you what, you go in, I'm going to sit in the car and starve. Reluctantly, I went in. And we stood for 5 minutes right by the sign that said, please wait to be seated. And finally, the hostess came and said, would you like to be seated? And I almost said, no, we prefer to eat standing. And she said, I'll get a table cleared. And she went away, and we waited 5 more minutes for her to reappear. Another waitress came by and said, would you like to be seated? I said, man, this is deja vu. I said, yes, please. So they went and they cleared the table and we sat to wait for our server. And we waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, no server. I got up to get a waiter in another section, and Sue said, be patient, sit down. But after 15 minutes, 20 minutes, even she was getting a little rattled. The people who came in after us were already eating. And so I went over and I tapped the shoulder of the waiter in the section next door. I said, we have languished here for 20 minutes and haven't even been waited on. To which he said, oh, the waitress who works your section is late for her shift. She'll be in soon. I said, and that means we're supposed to wait for her to come to work? And they gave this, walked away. Another waiter came and apologized for what had happened and took our orders. It wasn't long before he was back again and said, we're out of kids' meal macaroni and cheese. To which Ava said, I want a macaroni and cheese. He said, you can't have macaroni and cheese. Eat something else. When the food came, it was semi-warm. Sue's hamburger was lacking all of the condiments she ordered. We wanted to get out of that place as fast as we could. My son-in-law goes up to the checkout and he orders 2 shakes to go. He says, I'll meet you in the parking lot. So we're in the parking lot, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and I go in to see RJ fuming. I said, how long does it take to get 2 shakes? He said they finally made them and took them over to those 2 high school kids in the corner. They said, we didn't order them, but they took them. So would you make me 2 more? And we're still waiting. And I said, this is a joke. I'm looking for the manager. But there was no manager to be found. And I wanted to just shout, would someone tell me who is in charge around here? And I said to Sue, we would have avoided all this if you'd listened to me in the first place. Oh, who's in charge? There's hardly a day that goes by that we don't ask that question. Who is in charge? Who's at the helm? Who's minding the store? Because given these perilous times, this is not a trifling question. Given the environmental state of our world and looking down the road to seeing that looming crisis that is already happening, we wonder, who's going to stand up and take charge and lead in this area? Are we willing to change our lifestyles for our grandchildren who we say we love? And what kind of world are we going to give to them? I've already mentioned the blight of terrorism, and given the proliferation of the hatred and hellish extremism, we ask, who's in charge? Literally tens of millions of refugees are on the move, having had to leave their home countries that have been reduced to rubble. And no country wants to welcome them, including ours. Even though we had a hand in destabilizing that part of the world, to which our governor makes headlines, no Syrian refugees. There might be terrorists among them. Who's in charge? Where are the leaders with the moral conviction and courage to tell the truth? Tell the truth about the racism that still plagues our country. Talk about the disparities between the rich and poor. The people who have the vision and the courage to do something about it. You know, there's a line from Aesop's Fables that said, we should all make sure we know who is in charge. But my question is, who is it? From the current crop of presidential candidates, Are there any that give you great hope for the future? Is it an egotistical billionaire reality TV star? Is it a neurosurgeon? Is it a CEO? Is it a democratic socialist? How many of us really think that a president in and of him or herself is going to turn the ship around, to just all of a sudden make everything right? Even if he or she is a great leader with wonderful vision, what are the odds that the Congress won't kill everything that's sent his way? What I want to know and what I asked you today is, who is in charge? I read something from someone who had a radical proposal. They said that maybe democracy has reached its limits. Maybe what we need is to return to a monarchy. So what we really need is a king, someone who was born and bred to rule, someone who has the sense of sovereignty, divine sovereignty being given to them to do what's best. Not some ceremonial monarch like in England, where Queen Elizabeth knights important people like Paul McCartney and Elton John, almost said Elegant John, but that would be true too, wouldn't it? Who dubs them and they can go through life calling themselves sir. Not some ceremonial monarch who presides over the opening of the parliament or presides over garden parties. And we're not talking about the photogenic heirs that are on every cover of People magazine. What I'm saying and what this person says is, we could use a real king, someone with real authority, someone who would have the final say in matters of importance to the empire and to we, the commoners. Of course, that would never fly. The whole notion is laughable. I mean, we fought to rid ourselves of a king. We are free, autonomous people. We can do whatever we want. We can decide what 9 out of 10 Americans believe. The majority decides, even if that decision is influenced by political action committees and billions of dollars and corporations. No, a king wouldn't last a week in this country, but it kind of makes you wonder. You know, there were lots of kings in Jesus' day. His followers proclaimed him king. Notice I didn't say a king, They proclaimed him king, the one of whom the book of Revelation says the kingdoms of this world shall become the kingdoms of our Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever. Now that's a king. But this king was not treated like royalty because he didn't look like royalty. In the verses just before our lesson, Jesus is being interrogated by Annas. He's handed over to the Roman soldiers who beat him to a pulp, drape him in purple, shove a crown of thorns on his head, and mock him, saying, "There is the King of the Jews." Now in this text, John is trying to set up a very stark contrast for us between Pilate and Jesus. It appears that all the power belongs to Pilate, the one who was wearing the crown, not the beard. And he let Jesus know that he, with all the force of the Roman Empire behind him, was in charge. Can you picture them wearing the regal uniform of Roman authority, and Jesus just stands there wearing nothing but a bloodied garment? But you have a sense that as you read this drama, as Jesus is being passed back and forth between the powers of religion and government, that they don't know what to do with him. And they're fretting over that, and you see them as they really are, just a bunch of insignificant minions. And Pilate approaches Jesus with a smirk, and he says, "You are the King of the Jews. You don't look like one." And Jesus said, "Why do you ask? Are you asking this of your own accord because you really wonder if I am? Did somebody put this notion into your head?" And Pilate reminded me, "Your people put you in my hands. What do you have to say?" He said, "What I have to say is that I have a kingdom and it's not of this world." "So," Pilate says, "you are a king." Of course, we know those words, don't we, by heart? "You say that I am." Hold on to this story, because I want to overlay it with another story that was written by the Catholic priest and novelist Andrew Greeley. Perhaps some of you have read some of his works. He tells the story about a new boy who moved into the neighborhood just before the start of football season. He was thin, he was scrawny, he was clumsy. But he tried out for the football team, and in the process he made an absolute fool of himself. Fortunately, the coach had a kind heart and didn't cut him from the team. Every day, the kid came home from practice bruised and battered. Everybody made fun of him, but he didn't quit. He was quiet, but this kid was stubborn. There was a girl in the school who knew more about football than most of the guys. And she told the coach, "Look, I've seen this kid. He can run. He is faster than any player on our team." Well, it was the season opener against the school across town, the school that had beaten the home team for 20 consecutive years. They were bigger, and athletically, they were far better. And with 5 minutes to go, they held the home team scoreless, 13-0. And knowing they wouldn't catch up, the coach looked back at the scrawny kid and he put him in at safety. The quarterback drops back, he fires a pass, but it's tipped by a lineman and the ball floats right into the hands of this little kid who runs and he runs and he zigs and he zags and he's tackled just as he crosses the goal line and the opposing team piled on top of him. He just laid there a moment, mud all over his face. He was half dazed. He didn't come off the field. And the coach called for a two-point conversion, realizing he had forgotten to pull him out. The quarterback takes the ball. There he is. He pitches it to him, and the kid slices through the defensive line like hot butter. Well, the other team piled on him again. The refs didn't even call a penalty. The poor kid had to be carried off the field. They were down 5 points with 30 seconds to go. The coach thought of what the option would be, and then he took a deep breath and he put the kid back in. And the quarterback dropped back and he threw him a screen pass. And, well, you know the rest of the story. After the game, he was named the new team captain. And one of the big brawny linemen said he earned it because he learned how to take the worst and still win. He took the worst. He took the interrogation. He took the beating. He took the mockery. He took the desertion of his friends. For the disciples, the world was breaking into pieces. Team darkness was on top, 13-0. And Pilate brought Jesus out before the frenzied crowds and said, "Do you want me to release the King of the Jews?" And you remember what they cried? "We have no king. We have no king but who? Caesar. We have no king but Caesar." And I'm sorry to say that Caesar is still the king of choice. He's the only power left that most people in the world look to for help. We want Caesar to keep us safe, to keep the terrorists out, even if it means everybody will be under surveillance, and even if it means we have to build a big fence around the borders. We want him to protect our children and help them say no to drugs. We want Caesar to help us sleep at night and to give us comfort knowing that the lights will be on and the streets will be plowed. Christ is King Sunday is not an insignificant ritual in the life of the church. It reminds us that we all need a sovereign. We need the king that brought Caesar down to size. Because the Caesars of this world put on their pants and panties just like everybody else, you know? And the truth be told, if you could get them out of their role and sit them down and talk, they too would wonder, who's in charge around here? Gary Wills is a journalist who wrote a book in which he said, "The closest I ever felt to the pulse of history, it was on the morning after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. He arrived in Memphis the night before. He went to the hotel where Dr. King was shot, and then he went to the police to find out the funeral home that was taking care of the preparations. It was after midnight when he arrived, and there were only two other reporters waiting in the lobby of the funeral home. So they were going to sit there and wait for dawn. And as they were waiting, they could hear the morticians on the other side of the wall as they complained that they would have to build a jaw replacement, for the lower part of Dr. King's face had been blown away by James Earl Ray's bullet. And they could also hear a radio that was blaring. It was a black radio station that was playing all of Martin Luther King Jr.'s sermons and speeches. And when his body was brought out, the three reporters got a good look at King's face as the manager pinned the gauze over the coffin. And Gary Wills said it was the first time I had seen Dr. King, except in pictures. I thought he was dead, but I was wrong. When the foundations of the world are shaken, we look not to the kingdoms of this world, but the one who said, my kingdom is of another world. Now, don't get me wrong, there will always be work for politicians to do, vitally important work, but politics isn't the answer to what ails us. For our problems run deeper than that which presidents and politicians can ever handle. We need somebody bigger. We need somebody with deeper wisdom and understanding. We need someone who will only tell us the truth, someone who put Orion and Sagittarius in their place, someone who knows us each by name, someone pronounced dead and yet very much alive to us, someone who the black spiritual says holds the whole world in his hands. If you learn nothing else from this message, realize that we need a king. And so let me leave you with these words. Some of you may be familiar with the story of Amal in The Night Visitors. Hear these words. The one we seek doesn't need our gold. On love and love alone, his kingdom is built. His pierced hand will not hold a scepter. His haloed head will not wear a crown. His might will not be built upon our toll. Swifter than lightning, he will soon stand and walk among us. He will bring new life. He will receive our death. And the keys to his city belong to the poor. Amen.